The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujak, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
For many of us, August is the month when summer vacations reach their peak. The sun is high and the kids still haven't headed back to school, and so the rituals of hitting the road for that cross-country trip or maybe heading up north to vacation with family and friends continues. But the idea of taking a vacation wasn't always a part of our American culture. On this edition of UWM Today, we're going to talk about the history of vacations and how advertising has played a huge role in shaping our desire to get away. Joining us in the studio today is Rick Popp, Assistant Professor of Journalism, Advertising, and Media Studies at UW-Milwaukee. Welcome, Rick. Good to have you with us this week.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
So not only have you studied the notion of this ritual of vacation, but you've actually written a book about it. Tell us about that.
Right. Yeah. Well, I got interested in travel, sort of the history of travel, the sociology of travel, and so on. Number of years ago, I mean, I've always been, I've always enjoyed traveling. I've always, I think probably like anybody else, enjoyed vacationing and so on. But probably about mid last decade, 2004, 2005 or so, I started to really kind of look at it in a different sense. More from a scholarly angle. For a number of reasons, I think there's an area of communication theory and so on that's very much interested in the relationship between media technologies and transportation technologies. Primary reason being that, for most of human history, if you wanted to send a message, you had to physically move that message. That was something that very much interested me, got me interested in transportation technologies. Always been interested in the history of U.S. history in general, but also, sort of modern history, contemporary history. I was also, importantly at a point in my doctoral studies where, I needed to find a dissertation topic. And
why not go on vacation to write your PhD, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So I thought, this would be a topic that, I was interested in, for, various kind of, scholarly reasons, but also something that I thought would be interesting and, in some ways fun to work on, and it has been. I mean, it's been writing the book has been, about a 7-year process or so. The very last things I did with it were, probably about a half a year ago. So it was a long process, but I, stayed interested in it, pretty much the whole time. So,
well, in addition to that, there's also the sociology connected to vacations. I mean, we're talking about people who are doing something in their lives that for many years didn't happen. People didn't go on vacation before, right?
Right. That's, one of the things that I think that interests me so much about travel is that it is one of those things that is kind of, wrapped up, with our ideas of, what makes a, good standard of living, what, how we think about, consumer culture and so on. And travel, especially, tourist travel, is one of those things that for most of history, really up until about the turn of the 20th century, was really, the province of the very affluent. When most people traveled, it was, either to resettle somewhere else or, was surrounded by very, very, in a lot of cases, dire conditions and so on. So the idea of traveling for pleasure was something that very few people were able to do. And because of that, it was really in a lot of ways symbolic of, almost like a leisure class.
So when did it first start to change in our society where vacations became more mainstream?
Well, in the late 1800s, your upper middle classes are traveling more. People who aren't necessarily rich, but who I think you'd categorize as very well to do, very comfortable. Turn of the 20th century, the first couple decades of the 20th century, you begin to get sort of more comfortably middle class people who are traveling, and for the most part, it's people who have white collar jobs. Even up through the 1930s or so, there's kind of remains this feeling that the that white collar workers need a vacation because their brains need a rest, but that people doing blue collar type jobs, working class type jobs, that they don't necessarily need paid vacations because and obviously this is a classist sort of view that essentially that they don't need the same kind of recuperation, period.
Because they're not thinking as hard. And so the notion back then was that you needed to escape to clear your mind.
Right. Exactly. So in the 1930s, you get really for the first time a push where blue-collar workers are, in terms of, demands, for contracts and so on, there's more of a push than before for vacations. And really, it's in that period, the 1930s, the 1940s, that, what happens is that people begin to look at paid vacations as sort of an across-the-board kind of universal benefit that just about everybody should get. So it goes over the course of, probably a half century from something that, the accountants or somebody like that would get to something that, essentially everybody that's in the workforce, with the exception of domestic workers and a lot of, farm laborers and so on. It's basically assumed that everybody by, 1950 or so is going to have a paid vacation.
Thinking about that timeline that you describe, it occurs to me that there were two other things that were going on in American society. One was the beginnings of the labor movement, which mm-hmm. might have been pushing employers to acknowledge more than just the white-collar workers deserve to get off. I mean, there were demands that were coming from the rank-and-file workers in those factories to get a break, but also transportation. I mean, talk about that time period, that's when automobiles began showing up in people's driveways and garages, right?
Right. Yeah, those are both incredibly important factors. The first New Deal, the strengthening of the labor movement in the 1930s, and what you get is organized labor does begin to look at vacations in a very different way, in the sense that for one, it's something that workers wanted, but then also that it becomes, if people have more time off and so on, then it becomes a way of essentially managing the yearly calendar and so on to maximize employment and so on. But then also the second point, transportation is a huge part of it. And actually, that's one of the things that really got me interested in this time period, is that the period between the 1920s and the 1940s or so, if you look through especially magazines, and magazines would be the big one, but also newspapers and other media texts from this era, you see this kind of interesting collision between two technological eras in terms of transportation systems and technology and so on, where it's kind of the close of the era where people mainly got around by train and ship, and the beginning or the sort of the full flourishing of a car culture, and then the beginning of kind of commercial air travel.
And don't leave out horses. Back in the 20s, there you still see a lot of images of old-time Milwaukee in the 20s where there were horses parked downtown.
Right. Exactly. So you do, you have this sort of, sea change in terms of people's conceptions of, time, space, and how quickly you might expect to be able to get from one place to another place, and how realistic then it becomes to go from one place to another. So those two things are very, very important. Changing, sort of very broad changes in the way people think about work, and then also very broad changes and the rights of workers, essentially, the demands that they can make upon, employers as to, what should be part of their packages, work packages, in the sense that time off, time away from work is something that everybody needs. And not just, a weekend or not just an 8-hour day, but sustained blocks of time where you could actually go somewhere and really kind of clear your head and so on. And then also these changing, conceptions of how far it would be to go, from somewhere like Milwaukee to Western Europe, or to go from, from here to the Grand Canyon or something like that.
In your book, which is titled The Holiday Makers, you not only lay out some of these fundamental changes that occurred in society, but I think what's really interesting is the fact that you point to advertising and media in general, but particularly advertising, because there was a whole industry that was also evolving at the same time that saw that here's something they could sell, right? This whole notion of getting away.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that that's, you know, one of the key things that that I focus on in the book is the relationship between advertising and the tourism industry and the idea of selling places and the idea of selling, you know, the experience of getting away. You know, it's really, if you go back to even, say, the travel culture of the 1800s, advertising really plays a big part in it. The railroads in particular are really interested in this, you know, as early as, say, the 1870s, 1880s, and so on, and that they recognize that if they can get people interested in some of the places that are, you know, lie along the routes of their tracks, that, you know, this is a way of getting people to go out west and maybe even, you know, stay there, right? You know, so it becomes a part of this sort of larger booster effort to get people interested, to publicize somewhere like the Grand Canyon or Yosemite and so on. So from very early on, the railroads get interested in getting people out west. Then, you know, also you have the same sort of thing happening in some cases with the steamship lines. You know, if the steamship line runs to the Pacific, then they would promote places that were in the Pacific. And what happens in the mid-20th century, from about the 1920s on, and it's kind of a gradual process, is that places, actual destinations, whether it be, you know, sort of the official tourist bureau for an area, or it could be something that was kind of a pseudo-official body that was sort of, you know, charged with, you know, promoting somewhere like Southern California, a whole region or something along those lines. They begin to get really interested in promoting themselves and doing so in a way where they really begin to embrace what, you know, at the time is seen as kind of, you know, very technically sophisticated, kind of, you know, scientifically minded ways of advertising and of, you know, essentially promoting themselves and, you know, the particular places with the same kind of sophistication that a company like General Motors would, you know, use to try and promote a line of cars.
So if the railroads, for example, were at the forefront of encouraging more people to travel because they could make more money by not just moving stuff or things or animals, they could also move people.
Right.
If that was the first wave, how soon or how long did it take for those vacation hotspots to realize that they should get in on the action in terms of advertising, not just to go away, but to go away and come here?
It takes a good bit of time, you know. So you get the transportation companies begin to get into it in late 1800s, and it's really about the first sort of, you know, tourist bureau that really begins to promote itself in this kind of very, you know, modern, you know, technically sophisticated way is the All Year Club of Southern California, and it begins doing this in the 1920s. And one of the things it does is that it embraces market research and it begins to, you know, look at what the, you know, specific factors were that might keep somebody from taking a vacation to Los Angeles. And one of the things it finds is that at the time, people who did travel and if they wanted to go to Southern California, they sought a somewhere to go in the wintertime, and they assumed that it would just be too hot to go there in the summertime. So this group, you know, basically figures out that if it wants to get, you know, a year-long tourist season, essentially, that what they need to do is disabuse people of this notion that's going to be too hot to go to California, you know, in June or July or something like that. And so, you know, one of the things they do is that they adopt this name, the All Year Club, right, to basically say, hey, you know, Southern California is a nice place to go all year long. And that's the type of thing that, you know, probably wouldn't have occurred to a tourist board maybe in 1915, but by 1930 or so, the ones that are pretty forward-thinking are starting to look at, you know, the specific problems that they have to basically tackle in order to, you know, drum up a larger trade. And, you know, that's really kind of state-of-the-art for tourism promotion in the 1920s and the 30s and the 40s. And then you have another shift that happens in the 1950s, and I make the argument, the key person who's associated with this is he was a British advertising man, but he kind of made his reputation in the United States, David Ogilvy. And he had a very canny understanding of how to promote places. He was sort of a big shooting star in Madison Avenue or on Madison Avenue in the 1950s. And I think probably most people have seen a lot of his work. He's the person who came up with the idea of the figure of the Hathaway man, the dapper, sort of mysterious figure.
The eye patch on the model wearing the shirts and the like.
Right, exactly. So that was, he kind of made his mark with this campaign for Hathaway, this mysterious, you know, eye patched figure. He also put Schweppes, the company Schweppes, on the map in the United States. It was already a very big British company. And the way he did that was he essentially did the same thing as with the eye patch guy, where he created this figure. And the figure in this case was actually the person who was the president for North American sales, but he was this kind of sea captain looking person with a big beard. And he would feature Ogilvy, you know, basically said, hey, why don't you just appear in all the ads? You're, you know, kind of this compelling figure. So Ogilvy had a great imagination. He was able to sort of recognize, I think he had a very good understanding of the kind of consumer fantasies that that people have, you know, in terms of, you know, relationship between consumer desire and goods and so on. And that, I think, lent itself well to selling places. So he, beginning in the early 1950s, one of the accounts that his agency, which becomes Ogilvy and Mather, one of the accounts they get is essentially it's for the British Travel Association, or the BTA, the one underneath a couple of different names. But it was essentially the group that was tasked with trying to get American tourists to go to Great Britain on vacation. And over the course of a couple of years, what Ogilvy's firm develops is a type of tourism advertising that looks very, very different than anything that had come before it. It's very photographically driven. Their preference was to always use one, you know, really spectacular color photograph that took up almost the entire page of a magazine.
The glory shot, I think, is what they call it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, but, you know, something that would really draw the viewer in and make them feel as though they were looking at a scene that they were experiencing firsthand, right? So he had all sorts of rules as to, you know, what these shots should look like. And one of the stipulations he would say is, you know, the preference was always that there wasn't already people in the scene so that people could imagine, so that the magazine reader would look at this image and it would make it easier for them to imagine, insert themselves into the scene, right?
Just think, right?
Right.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. In the studio, we're talking vacations. What a great topic in this month of August when all of us either just got back from a vacation or maybe right now in the middle of one and trying to chart or get recharged for the upcoming year. Wasn't always that way, though. Our guest, Rick Popp, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Journalism, Advertising, and Media Studies at UWM, has written a fascinating book called The Holiday Makers, looking at the history or the evolution of vacations in American culture. Rick, as I hear you describe, you know, some of the great giants in advertising who helped shape this message, one of the thoughts that occurs to me is, when they first started doing this, were all of them trying to make vacation appear to be or travel appear to be glamorous? Or was it the notion of relaxation that sold the most?
Well, I think you get both. The type of travel that I was, you know, looking at most closely in here, I think by and large was packaged as something that was glamorous to do because in a lot of cases it was selling travel to a distant place. You know, it was selling essentially places that people may have for a very long time dreamt about going to. This was going to be a significant, you know, life event, you know, the first trip abroad, a trip to a national park that somebody had seen, you know, thousands of pictures of, seen it in films or something like that, and was actually going to see it themselves. And so generally it was, you know, packaged in a pretty glamorous way. And I think also part of that, too, was that there was a lot of glamour during this period of time that surrounded transportation and, you know, just kind of the general idea of being mobile, you know, because of these.
Well, and especially when you think about that time, airlines, right? I mean, the whole notion that Joe Sixpack and his kids could get on an airplane, you know, that used to be very exclusive back in the 30s and 40s when Pan Am started flying, very glamorous images. But 50s, 60s, especially, and then 70s, it all changed where suddenly we all became potential citizens of the world because airlines would fly and could cater to this much broader audience.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that that's a very good point. And there really is. I mean, I've heard people joke before about how, you know, in the 50s or the 60s or so, you know, if somebody was flying, they'd put on a suit, you know, and fly in you know, sort of your best clothes or something like that. And then nowadays we go, you know, put on like, you know, sweatpants or something like that, you know, just to be as comfortable as possible. And nobody really kind of looks forward to the, you might look forward to the trip itself, but the airplane journey itself is not usually something people, you know, look forward to. But
oh, wait. Are you telling me that the romance is gone?
Right,
Is gone from air travel? No, it's great taking off your belt and your shoes and
right.
And half of your other things as you go through. A little different from the 50s and 60s where you did walk around dressed to the nines, right?
Right, exactly. So there was, you know, airports and airplanes themselves were, you know, really kind of seen as, you know, some of the most glamorous places that you could be at that point in time. And there was really this whole network was almost kind of, you could look at it as like a you know, grid or something like that that overlaid the globe, at least in terms of how people thought about this kind of, you know, international travel circuit, where, you know, included airports. In a lot of cases, the airports were very new and they had this, you know, really sort of high international architectural sort of design to them. You know, you think about somewhere, it looks a little shabby now, but JFK Airport, you know, in New York was, you know, sort of this dazzling place. And same sort of thing, you know, the interior design of airplanes, but then also international hotels like Hilton was really the big one. And there's an interesting... if anybody watches Mad Men, there's one season where Conrad Hilton, the founder of Hilton, the Hilton Hotel chain, figures kind of largely into a number of episodes. And actually, he was a very big figure, you know, in terms of international travel during this period of time. But the Hilton hotels were, you know, kind of seen as these, you know, essentially almost nodes or something like that in this, you know, very glamorous international travel circuit that maybe people could move around on. But it did have this sort of huge glamour factor to it.
So is it your sense that the marketing drove the evolution of the travel industry as people on Madison Avenue came up with new ways of getting us onto trains or maybe off trains and onto planes? Or was it the industry itself? Was it you know, airlines and you know, the hotel chains and the like that were pulling us? Was there a push or a pull going on here in terms of the American public in particular suddenly becoming these world travelers?
There was both. I mean, people, you know, really did want to travel, you know, want to go out and see, you know, different places in the world. And there was, you know, just sort of genuine excitement about this idea that taking an elaborate vacation was going to become a much more common experience. Maybe not something that you did every single year, but something that you could do, you know, pretty often. And there was a sense for a couple of decades that, you know, these kinds of, you know, pretty expensive trips where you really went somewhere that was far away was going to become a part of people's lives, you know, sort of across a broad middle-income huge swath of American society in the same way that something like car ownership had. And so there was a lot of excitement. What the market researchers began to recognize, you know, by about the late 1950s, 1960s or so, is that in a lot of cases, you know, people that they had assumed would travel, you know, would use, you know, sort of additional income to travel, additional, you know, time off to travel and so on, didn't necessarily always want to adopt, you know, these new travel habits, and, you know, might use that time to do the sorts of things that they had traditionally done, like, you know, maybe take a more relaxing vacation, you know, go to the beach, go to the lake or something like that. And you also have a number of changes in the 1960s associated with changing transportation technology again, you know, where you have not just jets coming into the scene, but jumbo jets. And jumbo jets, you know, when they're designing them, they, you know, the airline companies and the you know, aviation companies have these sort of fantasies of them being jam-packed with people going on vacation, you know, all over the world and so on. And by the time they're ready, it's pretty much, you know, and they hit the market, it's pretty much apparent that big a market is not already there, you know, in a lot of ways.
And so that's where the advertising was key, because you had these big jets and they had to convince someone it was still glamorous or still exciting to get onto these jumbo jets.
Right, exactly. So,
and that's what I find so interesting in your work, that there was this interweaving of advertising that either was responding to or creating the actions that the traveling public either had or maybe didn't have yet.
Right. Yeah, you get a very interesting shift in the 1960s that I think is, you know, I argue is in a lot of ways sort of the precursor to a lot of the features I think that characterize, you know, today's travel culture, in that in the 40s and the 50s there really wasn't much of an emphasis on the idea of authenticity, or that a place is authentic, or that if you go somewhere and that there's already a lot of tourists there, or if it's somewhere that's kind of part of the sort of, you know, big tourism circuit, that place is somehow less authentic or something like that. But one of the shifts that you see in the marketing in the 1960s, and again, it's one of those things where it's sort of interesting, the sort of, is it a push or a pull kind of thing? I think, you know, looking at it closely, I think what they were responding to, because, you know, essentially you do begin to see places sold from the sense of this is an authentic place, it's off the beaten path. If you go there, you know, you're not going to be seeing something that, you know, hundreds of thousands or even millions of other people have already seen.
And that kind of catered to the whole individual notion of unique experiences as opposed to trying to impress others. Just got a minute left, but sure. And I do want to touch on this real quickly. Today, advertising, I would argue that it's all about price. And
right.
And so this whole notion of glamour, none of us buy that anymore. You know, we like the idea of maybe getting to where we want to go because of what awaits there. But this whole experience of can't wait to get to the airport is gone, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, I think so. I think that's something that, you know, it really is kind of a relic of the past, in that you don't see transportation companies very often, you know, trying to sell the actual places, or even trying to sell the idea of travel itself. Generally, the emphasis is on price, and they leave the promotion of places in a lot of cases up to the places themselves. Yeah.
Well, for our listeners who would like to go back in time when it was glamorous to fly and amazingly unusual to take these long trips, why don't you pick up Rick's book, The Holiday Makers? Nice read, and it's a lot of fun to see how our society and our ideas about travel have evolved. Rick, thanks so much for joining us.
Great. Thanks, Tom.
Rick Popp, Assistant Professor of Journalism, Advertising, and Media Studies at UWM, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. Well, that's all for this week's program. Thanks for joining us. We hope that you get away a little bit as summer wraps up and get a chance to get the cobwebs out and come back fresh. We'll be back next week with another program right here on UWM Today. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Nujak.
You've been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet the faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.